This is the Business Storytelling Show, a top global marketing podcast listened to in more than 100 countries, live streamed on social media, and broadcast on DBTV. Christoph Trapp chats with industry leaders to help your company tell better business stories. Here's today's episode.
Hey, business storytellers, how's everyone doing? Episode 634. Really excited that everybody's still tuning in and we're growing the show and we're sharing content that is interesting to me and that's useful to you. So always excited to talk to guests about what's going on the interwebs. Today, we want to talk about otherweb.com. You can already see the URL down below. You can also scan the UR code if that's your cup of tea. Lots of ads on the web. I mean, there's some websites. Oh my goodness. When can I get to the content? Pop up after pop up. There's an ad every three paragraphs. So Otherweb is trying to make that experience better for people. Alex Fink is the founder and CEO. He's going to give us an update how he is working on decoding the information jungle. Certainly, that's a tall task. Alex, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Nice to see you. So always like to hear, you know, kind of give us an overview of otherweb.com. Of course, it's available as an app on the website, newsletter, et cetera, et cetera. What is it and what prompted you to develop that product?
So I'll start with what prompted me, right? I've been developing perception systems for something like 15 years, cameras, computer vision, that sort of thing. And at some point, it just dawned on me that we don't need more cameras. In fact, we don't need to produce even more information because we're failing to make sense of what we've got. At the end of the day, for some reason, people are consuming junk. And so I decided to dive into that, try to figure out how to help people consume slightly higher quality content. And the Otherweb was born. It's basically an aggregator of news, commentary, podcasts, research studies, anything we can get our crawlers on. There's an AI engine that filters obvious junk out and tries to give the user as much control as possible to sort what they see and in what order.
So how does that look in practice, though? So if you're basically, I mean, you're creating this experience, and what's obvious junk? I mean, isn't that not, I mean, there's obvious spam, I guess, but that's also in the eye of the beholder to an extent, right?
Right. So junk is a little bit hard to define. What we know how to define are specific small traits that everybody can agree on, like, is this headline clickbait or not? And if the headline is clickbait, that makes the content slightly more likely to be junk than if it weren't, right? And we found about 20 of these traits that it seemed like everybody can, for the most part, agree on. And we score content based on these traits. Now, some things are obviously binary, kind of dangerous. Like if the content is hateful, offensive in some way, we label that. And we actually created a nutrition label for every item on the website. So people can look at that before they decide to read the whole article. Besides that, we also try to add a bullet point summary for every item. So again, that's just a heuristic for the reader to make a quicker decision on whether or not they want to commit to reading the entire piece. Or maybe just based on the bullet points and the nutrition label, they decide this is not for me.
You know, I'm just so interested in how companies now use AI to like measure everything, right? I mean, when I'm looking at your nutrition label, I mean, you have on there, you know, language complexity, offensive language, hate speech, attention grabbing headline, which that I guess might not be horrible if it's attention grabbing, but clickbait certainly is annoying. And then you also have use, this is the most interesting one to me, just looking at it here, use of known propaganda techniques.
Yep.
And so when you detect that, that could be a problem, right? Because somebody's really, truly just trying to overly manipulate you, I guess.
Right. And that's based on an academic data set. So to some extent, a small startup like ours cannot reinvent everything. So we try to rely on work that has been done before. So the QCRI, which is an institute that investigates propaganda, they published a data set of examples of use of known techniques. And we trained the model on that data set. And it detects things pretty well. So for the most part, if something is flagged on a particular technique, then I take a look at it and it looks to be about right. So that's why we're flagging it in our nutrition label. Now, each of those line items that you see there is just a small part of the overall rank that everything is sorted by, right? And in fact, a lot of the sorting is also personalized. So even this overall objective score of content is just a part of how we sort it. It's not everything, but I think it's useful for people.
Yeah, it's useful. It's interesting. You have to look at the totality of what's going on, certainly. I mean, the whole, you know, so is there an example? Let's stick with the propaganda thing for a second. If you do really good marketing, but I guess you don't publish marketing content, but some content marketing is useful. Is it always bad if you use propaganda techniques, depending on what it is, or is it because it's more of a news model, not necessarily a B2B content marketing model?
It's not always really, really bad. And this is why I want to look at this as there's 20 things that could potentially be bad that we know how to recognize. Each one of those accounts for a small part of the score. So even if the article that we're analyzing is full of red herrings, which is something that propaganda do a lot. Like that's one of the 17 propaganda techniques that are known, the extensive use of red herrings. Then, okay, that might reduce the overall score by 3 points. If they also had a clickbait headline, maybe that will reduce it by another 3 to 5 points, right? And so the overall score is essentially 100 minus all the bad things we've recognized.
Yeah, it's just so interesting. So when you go up, so who's like the perfect person to sign up? So I'm certainly a news junkie. I want to read as much as I can, but I do also get annoyed, by all the ads and paywalls, maybe. Depends who it is, right? I mean, I'm not going to sign up for 20 local newspapers because I want to read 20 articles, right? But like the New York Times, I don't care if I have to pay for them, quite frankly. Within reason. I mean, if they were to hike the rates so much that it was out of this world. But who typically is the app, is it developed for that, you know, they need to have otherweb.com and it's really useful for them to use that product?
There's actually two very different types of users. The first one is the news junkie. And one of the benefits we provide to the news junkie is there's hundreds of sources in the same spot. They cover the entire range from left to right. Everywhere from Breitbart to Mother Jones, right? There is a way for you to pick the best of each category. So you read something that is broad, but you still kind of take the top 10% of every type of content of every political positioning possible, right? And you can skim through a lot of content by reading just the summaries and only dive into an article if you're sure that you want to consume the whole thing. So this is the junkie scenario. Now, the other archetypical type of user we have is somebody who checked out of the news a long time ago because it's too emotional, too infuriating. It gives them a bad feeling every time they consume it. And this is a way for them to be informed without all the emotional baggage. Like, they just select the purely informative things that don't have too much emotion or sensationalism attached. And they just skim the summaries to know what happened today. And so that category is actually fairly large. I think the last data I've seen is that 42% of all American adults are consciously avoiding the news right now. And so we are a way for them to still know what's going on in the world without all the negative effects that caused them to quit the news to begin with.
You know, it's kind of interesting. I mean, I certainly don't watch the news at all. And every time I do, I wonder why this is not local news to begin with, right? I mean, they're showing national news. So it's like, what's the point? Local newspaper, not so much anymore, right? Because it's no offense to my friends in journalism, but it's like press release journalism, right? Somebody sends out a press release and they publish it. I could just get that from the source. So it is very disheartening. I grew up in journalism that people don't even consume the news anymore, and where journalism has ended up to an extent, right? All these budget cuts over the last couple of decades and jobs being slashed. How do you, when you aggregate the content, how does that work? And how do companies feel about that when you aggregate their content? Do you link back to them, or how does that experience look?
Well, so we're trying to be as friendly as possible and to be really responsible with what we do, right? So we try to aggregate as much content as we can, But first of all, if a website has a paywall, we don't take anything from it. The paywall basically tells us they prefer not to share. So even though paywalls don't really block crawlers, they only block humans, we ask our crawler not to go there anyway. So you will actually see that the New York Times is not on the other web, for example, just because they have a paywall. We respect that. There are enough other sources that aren't paywalled to basically get some version of the same event covered through other sources. We also always link back under the summary. There's a link to the original article. In fact, the fact that we create our own summary means we don't grab any piece of text from the original article. We reword it in a shorter version, but there is no excerpt like other aggregators typically include. And obviously, if anybody asks us to take their content down, not to scrape their website, we will respect that 100% of the time, because our goal is not to compete with others in this market. Our goal is to help people select content better and then go to the source and read it.
You know, what's interesting to me about that too, when you talk about we summarize the article, I mean, it is about the content, right? It's, I mean, certainly it needs to be produced in a way that makes sense. But if you can give me a very quick summary of something and it helps me understand what's going on, certainly that's helpful. The other thing that I found very interesting is, so somebody has up a paywall and they have a content piece on whatever, and you just go looking for the place where you can get it for free or where it's wide open. So at the end of the day, all these companies throwing up paywalls, right? Unless every single content creator in the world has a paywall.
Right.
It doesn't work, right? Unless your content is so unique that it doesn't exist anywhere else.
They're trying to solve a real problem, right? But the solution they're trying to use is not going to work in the long run. Maybe for now, in the short term, it works for the New York Times and maybe the Washington Post, even though they're not doing really well lately either. But obviously, it's not going to work in the long run. The actual problem that they are all facing is that if you look 20 years ago, content could only from that moment on be monetized using ads. Ads pay per click or per view. And so essentially they're in a competition for clicks and views, and quality doesn't really matter anymore, or at least it doesn't pay. So they have the professional incentive to produce good stuff, but it is actually competing with the commercial incentive to produce clickbait. And over time, all the content is drifting towards clickbait. We've been observing this for 20 years. What we're going to start seeing now is going to make the problem even worse, because now content is becoming cheaper to create, especially bad content. Instead of producing 10 or 15 clickbait articles per year, the same guy who is working for BuzzFeed, let's say, can now produce 150 with the help of ChatGPT. And so the number of clicks to go around remains roughly the same, but there is a lot more content and it's much cheaper to create, especially on the lower end, and it is competing for the same clicks. And so they're going to be in this cauldron of pressure from all sides to try to somehow still maintain the eyeballs while trying to also maintain the quality. And I don't think there's a solution to this, really. It's the paradigm has to shift somehow. Otherwise, the existing media just won't survive.
Yeah, it's just so interesting. I mean, I don't know that I agree 100% that... mainstream journalists, and certainly some people don't fall in this category, but that they, you know, they create content that sells as opposed to what they think is a good story for their audience. So there is like that fine line. Do you know what I mean? Like you want to have a good headline to draw people in, because at the end of the day, I remember back in the day when you read newspaper headlines, some headlines were horrible. And you know what, Alex? It didn't make any difference because that was the only place I could read it anyways, right? So they didn't have to... I know they would never admit it, but some of these headlines were bad, but people would never admit that it wasn't the best headline, right? But that was the only place. So now, for you to even get me in, you have to have a good headline, like whether you like it or not, because, you know, there's so much competition. But let's do talk about financials for a second. So certainly the newspapers and other places, they're chasing clicks to an extent, right? That's how they make money, subscriptions, whatever. How, like, what does it cost me to become a user of Otherweb, or what does that business look like?
Yeah, right now it's free and ad-free. So there's no monetization whatsoever. It doesn't cost you anything. And we are not monetizing your attention in any way. Obviously, over time, that will have to change. But for now, the investors are footing the bill for us to give you the best experience possible and hopefully to create a large cohort of users that can signal to the world that quality matters. That's why they're on the other web.
I know you have the slogan of or one of the features, hands-free news reading. Let's talk about that for a little bit. What does that look like? Is that audio or what does that refer to?
Yeah, so the general idea is that instead of reading the summaries, you can have them narrated to you and you can control the app with voice commands. And the general idea is we've noticed that some users prefer to consume news while they're driving or while they're at the gym. And it's pretty difficult to do using any of the existing readers. So hands-free operation kind of works well for audiobooks and for longer types of content, but for news, nobody made it work so far. So we're trying to be the first.
You know, what's interesting to me about that functionality is back in my days as a newspaper person, you know, 15 years ago now or so, I actually made that recommendation. We should put audio of the articles on the website. And people thought that was, I was crazy. Nobody would ever listen to content, a news content. And I know people do it all the time. I do it all the time. I listen to news content like it's a podcast. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I'm very interested in trying that out.
I want to make a note here that I kind of agree with what you've been told a while ago, and that if what's being narrated is entire articles, then it wouldn't really be listenable, because the way I read entire articles today is I skim them first. And then if it looks interesting, I dive deeper. And I think most people do that. So narrating summaries of articles and then asking people whether they want to dive in, I think that works. But narrating 2,000 word articles one after the other, I'm not sure that's a pleasant experience for someone.
So how, talk about the concept of having summaries. So that's interesting, because I, you know, I mean, who has all the time in the world to consume all this content to begin with? But what makes a good summary? Like, how long is it? Like, so if you have a 3,000 word New York Times article, how long is the actual summary that you guys might publish, or whoever the publisher is?
Yeah, we will probably create somewhere between 3 and 10 bullet points.
Okay.
With basically trying to cover the major things that were covered in the article, right? So if there are specific facts and then a commentary on the facts, we will try to just list all the facts or the main points of view that the author wrote. And again, when I say we, that means an AI summarizer model that we created, right? But the general idea is we just want a person to know what is the main message of the article, what is it about, what does it say? And then if they want to dive deeper and read the entire thing, then we welcome them. The link is right there. But this kind of echoes my own experience, where if I see a 3,000 word article, the first thing I'm going to do is try to quickly scan it to see what is the message. What are they saying here? And if that message is something that I don't want to know about more about right now, I probably don't want to read the whole article.
The whole length on content is kind of an interesting discussion, quite frankly. I mean, sometimes it truly just depends on when I'm seeing the content, right? I mean, I saw an article the other day. It was just going on and on and on and on and on. But I was doing something else and I had a moment. So I started reading it and then I'm like, oh, I don't have time to read, you know, 12,000 words right now, or however long it was. So a summary certainly can help in those instances. How do you see the future of news evolve? I mean, what does it look like? And I mean, at the end of the day, yeah, I think, I mean, the problem has been, right, companies haven't made as much money as they may have made previously. I'm not going to say they're going totally under, because newspapers, right, their margin was really, really high back in the day. And certainly things have changed. So how do you see the news business evolving over the next 5 to 10 years?
So again, my big concern is that producing high quality content is just as complicated as it was in the past. But producing low quality content is getting easier and easier. It's becoming cheaper. And so I think what we're going to see in the next 5 to 10 years is that the total volume of news content being produced is going to increase by two orders of magnitude. We're just going to see a lot more stuff published. We'll see a lot more publications, even than the quite large number of publications we see now. And it's going to become fairly difficult to find needles in that haystack. So to some extent, you can think of it as email between the 90s and now, right? The volume of emails being sent is much larger, but 95% of all of that is spam, right? And the reason our mailboxes look roughly the way they looked 20 years ago is that spam filters have developed just as fast as spam generators, essentially. So I think we should see the same kind of process, at least on the consumer side and the news business, where everybody will end up with some version of a spam filter. Now, what does that look like for the high-quality outlets that are trying to produce good journalism? I'm not sure. I think they need to come up with a better model because they are about to get squeezed even more than they have been squeezed so far. And this model of trying to compete with the clickbait artists, I don't think it's going to work for them in the long run. You mentioned that even in the past, you saw bad headlines. I've talked to hundreds of journalists so far in this journey. And there is a complaint I keep hearing over and over and over again. I wrote a good piece with a good headline and the editor changed it to clickbait, right? And I don't want to blame the editors here. It's just that the editors are the ones that have to worry about the bottom line at the end. They probably get judged on it. And so I see a lot of that internal friction there as well.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting too, because in my model of content creation, you know, the writer, the content strategist writes everything, right? So when I file an article, I have the headline too. And certainly back in my journalism days, which was in the print era, I wrote an article and somebody else wrote the headline, and sometimes it was completely wrong to begin with. When you talk about how easy it is now to create not so good content, I'm thinking about the whole thing with Sports Illustrated, right? They have had those AI writers make product recommendations, and I'm a big fan of AI. I'm sure you're too, right? Because you use AI in your product. Yeah. Right. But if you're going to have AI write a product recommendation for me, how does it even know? So there is certainly that fine line.
It's not like the humans writing product recommendation really care about the products. Most of them have never seen them. They just do a Google search of what's popular on Amazon and just list them one after the other. And the worst part is this appears on websites like Forbes.com. If you Google best protein powders, Forbes.com is like the number two or number three result. Why are they ranking protein powders? Beats me, but it has something to do with clicks.
Well, they're ranking because they've built that authority over time, right? And it's very interesting to me, actually, when you mentioned that example. I mean, Forbes used to be covering very different stories than the best protein powder or whatever. But very interesting. Very interested to see how the information jungle continues to evolve really quickly here. The last 20 seconds, Alex, really appreciate you coming on. But kind of tell us, how do people sign up? How do they get involved?
So please go to otherweb.com or download the app called Otherweb on Android or iOS. Or if you don't use us, please use something else just to make sure that you consume higher quality content. We're all paying attention to what we put into our mouths. It's time we all start paying attention to what we put into our brains.
Thanks for tuning in. Please rate and review The Business Storytelling Show on your favorite podcast platform and subscribe so you don't miss the next episode. See you then.